This is Teresa Gennaro, and I'm sitting in for Frank Vespi on this edition of the Racing Business Blog Talk Radio. This is the latest in our series of conversations about diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice in thoroughbred racing. We call our series Truth to Power. Frank can't be with us tonight. He's taking some well-deserved time off. But as always, Alicia Hughes is here. Alicia, as most of you know, is the digital content editor of TVG. She has served as the NTRA Director of Communications and has a long, long resume of turf journalism jobs, including Blood Horse and the Lexington Herald Leader. Hi, Alicia.
Hi. Thank you guys again, as always, for having me on. Like I said, you know, this is always, I said, these topics are deeply personal to me. So I said, it's always grateful to have a platform for everybody to share their perspective and their wisdom and share their truth more than anything.
And we've got two great guests joining us today. Rod Hicks, who is a native of Birmingham, Alabama, and has experience at numerous news organizations across the country. He's been an editor at the Associated Press, which managed news coverage in 10 states, and he worked on several major stories there, including the Sandy Hook school shooting, the Boston Marathon bombing, and the sexual assault trials of Bill Cosby. He has served as suburban editor of the Detroit News and has also been an instructor of journalism at Talladega College, which is an historically Black institution in Alabama, where he's also served twice as a visiting professor at the University of Alabama. He has led the planning and execution of three conventions for the National Association of Black Journalists. He currently serves as the Director of Ethics and Diversity for the Society of Professional Journalists, where he also served a term as the Journalist on Call, and we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. So welcome, Rod.
It's really good to be here, Teresa. Hope I can answer the questions that you have and you know, we dig into these issues.
Sue Finley's name is going to be familiar to a lot of you who follow racing at all. She is the owner and publisher of the Thoroughbred Daily News. Before we came on air, she was talking about her decades in the journalism business. She was a senior media coordinator for the New York Racing Association, a researcher for ABC's Wide World of Sports, the director of administration and publicity for the American Championship Racing Series. Her educational background is fascinating to me. She's got degrees in French and journalism, as well as a professional certificate in philanthropy and fundraising. Sue recently wrote in the TVN about the promise of equine therapy for military veterans with PTSD, in which she shared the story of her father, who had been held as a prisoner of war in World War II. Sue, thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Teresa. It's you know, it's obviously an important topic, and I'm glad that we're starting to talk about it more and more.
So, Rod, we're going to start with you about what does it mean to be a journalist on call generally, and what did it mean given the fact that you were in that role during some pretty incendiary times in our country between politics and protests and the intersection of those with sports as well?
Sure. The journalist on call position was created by the Society of Professional Journalists to try to address this issue of dwindling trust in the news media. Since the mid-1970s, trust in news media has been dropping and it has fallen precipitously. There was a slight bump recently, but it's still way, way below where it was back in the right around Watergate. And so what SPJ wanted to do is to try to figure out why do people not trust the media, and what, if anything, can do to help them to understand that media, provided that you go to the right sources, can be very helpful to people in their communities and to democracy in general. As part of this job, one of the things that I did, and you're right, it was right in the middle of it was around the time that politics became as tribal as it has become. Like, you pick your sides and you stick with those sides. And I went to Wyoming and did a project project there for 6 months, where we gathered together people at least half of them had very little trust in the media. Some trusted it more. But we wanted to, and we did like the regular trips there, talking to these groups of people. At the time that I went, the Mueller investigation was going on. The Mueller report came out during the time that I was there. And you know, there was a lot of tribalism going on there, as I mentioned. It was people really felt like the mainstream news media was out to get President Trump, and they dismissed all of it. The people who were for Trump just would not accept hardly anything that they read in the mainstream media, so on mainstream TV, that was said about Donald Trump. And the issues that he supported, they supported, and anything that basically he could do no wrong, and that any problems were with the media and not with Donald Trump. I can go into more detail, but I don't want to dominate the time. I'm just, if you have some more specific questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Well, it seems like that sort of your job was to counteract the entire narrative of fake news, that term that became so prevalent over the last, 4 to 5 years. That must have been quite a task.
Well, let me tell you, we did poll the people at the beginning of the project to see what their news consumption habits were. Where did they go turn to for news? And over the course of those 6 months, we had in speakers to come in to talk to them, people who were familiar with journalism. One of the speakers was the executive director of the Center for News Literacy at Stony Brook, who had been an editor at, I think, Newsday previously. And we also exposed them to a panel of local journalists as well as national journalists. We got people from the Wall Street Journal, from the Washington Post, the Associated Press, and BuzzFeed News to come to Casper, Wyoming, to answer questions that people had. We opened this up to the public, and so 200 people showed up. But out of all of that, when we polled people at the end of it, there was, very little difference in how people felt about the media, and very little difference in what media they turned to get their news and information. So that's interesting to know. I would not call the project a failure because of that, because I went in, it's hard to change people's minds, period. And I went in knowing that. But the thing that was interesting is that most of the people in our post-project survey said that they appreciated the opportunity to get off of their chest what they wanted to say to, in particular, the national news media. They also appreciated hearing the processes that journalists go through to verify information and to make sure it's correct, although I'm not so sure that they believed it because they still are clinging to the media that they did before. I did not try to steer them to any media in particular. I just wanted to hear what media they got their news from, and from listening to all the journalists explaining what they do and showing that they go through a lot of work to try to get every detail right, that might make them think a little differently about the media. I think the only thing they walked away with is that I'm a nice guy. I don't even think that they apply that to most news media people.
Well, that's a start, I guess. At least that they were willing to at least believe the messenger. Coming from a different perspective, I think the TBN has a reputation as one of the most trustworthy publications out there for people who pay attention to racing. Yet I know that in some of the stories you've written and published, the pandemic, protests, and politics of the last few years have certainly affected your publication as well. And what are some of the issues that you've faced regarding those movements?
I wouldn't say we've faced any issues, but I think racing is a right now a predominantly white, predominantly male dominated sport. And I think at the very beginning, we have to address that fact, admit that fact, and talk about it. I'm going to say over the past several years, my own perspective has changed to some degree, as have most Americans, I would hope, in that I used to say, well, first of all, the TDN is diverse from a standpoint of male to female. We're 77% of our workforce is female, including every top position except for one. So we are 20 women to 6 men at the TDN. That said, I've never had an applicant of color apply for a job with us. And I used to think that just was what it was. And now I think, you know, we all have to realize that we need to go out and cultivate that community to participate in the sport, because it's important to hear their perspective. And you can't do that if your own writers are all sort of homogeneous.
Alicia, I think you had a question that speaks directly to what Sue's talking about.
Yeah, I said this is Alicia speaking here. I said, and this is both to, you know, to Rod and to Sue. This is a broad question that may seem obvious, but I think, as you know, as Sue just spelled out, it's not that cut and dry, not that simple. Why does diversity in media matter, and what are some of the tangible impacts that you both have seen, whether statistically or otherwise, as far as the impact of seeing diversity in media portrayals, or the flip side of it, what is the impact of not seeing diversity in media portrayals?
Rod, do you want to take that first, or do you want me to take it first?
I can address it first.
Okay.
I think that there's a recent example, I think, of this. I'm going to just mention two things. The recent example is when there were those killings in Atlanta of the spas where some women of Asian descent were killed by a gunman. News organizations were not knowledgeable enough about those communities to really cover them with the nuance and texture that they deserved. They did not have anyone to speak the language, two languages that some of the victims spoke. No one there spoke the language, and there was not a really good understanding of the culture. If in a perfect world, there would be people who, first of all, there's two issues. One is there would be people on the staff who were familiar with the community. And second, that would be, even if you're not from those communities, you would know more about them, because that's part of it. News organizations should know the communities that they cover. The distant example, which still holds true, is back in the 1968. When the Kerner Commission was put together, one of the things that they looked at was coverage of African Americans. And what they concluded is that, the portrait that emerged of Black people in mainstream media was severely distorted. One, because the stories that you read were about crime, and it was about suffering and things like that. There were no meaningful stories about how people live their daily lives, doing normal things. And that's the consequence of it. I mean, this went on for years, that there was this portrait of an entire race of people in this country that was inaccurate because of the community not being covered. And so there were some efforts to try to change that. The Kerner Commission suggested hiring more Black people on your staff, both as reporters and as managers, to help turn that around. 10 years later, the American Society of Newspaper Editors set a goal of having newsrooms across the country to match, have their staffs match the racial and ethnic diversity of the country, and that by the year 2000, and that did not happen. And in fact, after ticking up a little, it just fell back down because there was not a commitment to it. And so the goal has been reestablished for 2025. That's just right around the corner, and I'm not optimistic that they're going to meet that.
Too, did you want to add a point to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what Rod says is spot on, and I think it's funny that you mentioned earlier the article I wrote about PTSD and veterans. The reason I could write so compellingly about PTSD and veterans is that my father had PTSD and was a veteran, and that's how I grew up. And the same holds true for, writing about Black people in horse racing. It's a much more compelling read if the person is deeply knowledgeable about the subject. And so, you know, at the TDN, we've tried to give a first-person voice through a series on diversity we did to Jason Wilson, Alicia, Jonathan Kinchin. But unfortunately, I just, with the exception of Ken Rudolph, pretty much summed up, the majority of the African Americans in horse racing today.
And Alicia, going back to, go ahead, Teresa, sorry.
Nope, you go.
Oh, no, I was just going to, to follow up, and actually I'm actually going to cite an article that you actually brought to my attention, going back to Rod's point about, knowing your community, the people you covered, how it could influence it. You actually shared an article last week, I believe, from the Harvard Radcliffe Institute about the Black Lives Matter protests and how they were overwhelmingly peaceful. And it said, that the data suggested that 96.3% of the events involved no property damage or any injuries. In many instances, any of the kind of violence or anything that kind of escalated was as a result of actually of the police kind of escalating it. Yet it was framed, and so obviously in many respects, as these violent protests. What role do you all think that the media had kind of played in perpetrating that sort of narrative? And do things like that kind of contribute to the distrust of media that we kind of see going on right now?
I was going to say, I think that, when you turn on one station and you hear protests referred to as riots all of the time, it gives the people who watch that station the idea that that's what's happening, that these are riots. And so, that kind of language choice is so important, and it's obviously deliberate on the part of certain media. And like Rod said, people watch what they believe, and it just reinforces the ideas that they already have. And, it's a dangerous situation we find ourselves in America right now.
Yeah, the thing that I would add to that is what journalists look for is drama. And if there are flames coming from a police station, or there are images of people throwing trash cans, breaking down windows of department stores, that's considered in journalism as compelling video. The problem is that when you loop these things and show it over and over, that becomes the reality to people. They don't know that it happened yesterday or 2 days ago, because that video gets shown over and over again. And that's part of the problem. How do you show, what's dramatic about a peaceful protest? I mean, how do you capture that and hold people's attention? I mean, I'm just talking from the perspective of journalists. I do think it's a problem because it distorts reality. It distorts the, 93% peaceful protests, when all you see are these dramatic images of basically crimes being committed.
Yeah,
And I think we've seen over the last year or so the idea of activism versus objectivity in journalism begin to be questioned in really, I think, productive and positive ways, where sort of the myth of objectivity has been smashed. We've seen some people removed from beats in which they had personal experience, thinking of the reporter at the Washington Post who had been a victim of sexual harassment, and she had been removed from covering that, which had been her beat, because her editors thought that she couldn't be objective, which sort of flies in the face of what we were saying about being able to really write about the community and the people that you know, and vice versa. You know, Alicia, you and I were talking before we came on about the comment that Barkley Tagg made, and I don't like to, you know, sort of just single him out, but he was on the biggest stage. This is the August 2020 teleconference, and Barkley had, I think he was the favorite, right, to the law going into the Kentucky Derby last year, and there were a number of protests that were going to be scheduled to coincide with the Derby following the death of Breonna Taylor, and Tagg was asked, how concerned are you about safety for the horses and the humans? And he responded, they can shoot us, but we can't shoot them. There would be one school of thought that would say, okay, I just report that. Like, that's my job. I'm the journalist. I report. I asked a question. I got my answer. How do you both feel, Rod and Sue, and maybe Sue, you can take this one to start off with, what is the responsibility of a journalist in that moment? Does a journalist push back and say, well, actually, you know, there's not a lot of violence going around these protests, or you do just get your answer and move on?
No, I think we have a tremendous responsibility. On that Derby day, I sat and watched the very peaceful protests all day long so that we could report about it appropriately, so that people couldn't get away with saying things like he did. I also think for the first time in horse racing ever, we're talking about these issues a lot more than we used to. And I'm not so sure that 15 years ago, we would have even reported what Barkley Tagg said. We might have said, wow, that's really inappropriate, and just moved on. We might not have reported about the guy who was posting racist tweets, you know, or Eric Guillot also posting racist tweets. I'm not sure we would have given that the coverage that we do now. And the fact that we do, I think, has caused a lot of good to happen. You know, you see people being banned for this sort of hate speech in a very appropriate way. And I think that the media has a real responsibility to publicize these, you know, really horrible, hateful things that people say for that reason, in horse racing specifically. You know, I thought of, you know, in our diversity series that we did, it was really depressing to hear people like Jonathan Kinchin say he goes to the track with his buddies and he's asked for his ticket four times, where everybody else has asked for it once, because people just assume, security guards, that he doesn't belong in the winner's circle or he doesn't belong in the paddock. And I think even before George Floyd, I think that as Americans, we all knew there were huge racial problems in the country. I don't think until cell phones and police body cams that I certainly understood just how bad they were. I knew it was bad, but, you know, when you see the sort of things happening now that we see every day, you know, just ignoring it and hoping it'll get better isn't good enough anymore.
And Rod, you've been an educator. I'm curious about how you talk to student journalists about these issues and what sort of advice you give them. Also, you know, keeping in mind that young Black journalists might be also subject to physical threats that young white journalists might not be.
Yeah, we did a story in our, we did a story and we did a webinar at the Society of Professional Journalists last summer that talked about how to protect yourselves while you're covering protests, because not only is there danger if people start rioting, there's also danger from the police. The police had actually targeted some journalists in pepper spraying and even beating some journalists. So there are some tips on how to stay safe. I do want to say, though, that in the example that you use of the insensitive comment, I think it is fine for journalists to, first of all, publish that comment, but also to correct people in real time, to fact check people in real time. And you can say, well, actually, most of protests are peaceful, and then see, do you want to respond to that now that that wasn't peaceful? I think that's perfectly fine to do. And I think that to the extent that we can, we should correct people who have these incorrect views on reality. But you have to be, of course, you have to be accurate. So check them and see what they say. So we teach, well, what I hope you teach, it's been a long time since I've been in the classroom, but one of the things that we do at SPJ through our code of ethics is one of our principles is to minimize harm. And that goes to sources. So anything that you can do, well, you have to use your journalism credentials wisely and not do anything that's going to harm in life. For instance, there's still a debate about whether we should run photographs of people who are protesting because some of them were getting threats. So that's one of the issues, and that falls under our minimize harm. But yeah, in general, I just think that we as journalists have to be aware of how information will be received when people say it, and to the extent that we can push and try to get them to address what is reality and not their stereotypes or their misinformation.
And Rod, sorry, this is Alicia, just to jump in and follow up on that point and to go back to the topic of Barkley Tagg and his statement. Personally, I thought the fact that he was even being asked a question about, are you concerned about your safety for the humans and horses? I thought that was a bit of a dog whistle question myself, and talking about, the accuracy and everything, because especially, we have seen over the past, 2 years, really, there's been many animal rights activists who have protested at racetracks across the country. And we have seen some of those animal rights activists even break into racetracks and get onto the racing surface and disrupt racing. And yet I cannot recall any reporters asking trainers, are you concerned about your safety for yourself and your horses when these predominantly white animal activists are physically breaking into your track? Yet when it's a protest about predominantly brown and black people, you're now asking about the safety. So I think that the fact that that question was even asked illustrates why diversity is so important, because it really does shape the lens that we view so much of our information through and how that is disseminated accurately.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. You make a really good point on that.
And, Rod, I'm going to steal a stat from an article actually from that you wrote, where you cited the 2019 Census Bureau actually estimated that 42% of Americans identified their race as something other than white, yet they made up only about 22% of print and online newsrooms. How can these news organizations expect to authentically engage with their communities if they don't have that kind of diverse makeup themselves? And what sort of maybe hiring pipelines are available to leaders of these organizations that are maybe not being fully utilized right now?
I think it'll be difficult for you to really fully cover the community with that type of disparity. What it takes, though, what it really takes is the top person, the leadership at news organization has to be committed to diversity. They have to understand the value of it, both to, I mean, it's just good journalism. It's not good journalism to ignore or to undercover significant parts of your news coverage area. That's just not, it's not good business, and it's not good journalism. So that's, you know, a reason there. But it takes a commitment from somebody at the top, and they have to enforce it. It's not even good enough to say, all right, I really believe in diversity, but then allow those who are under you to not, make moves to diversify your staff. That is, I think, the biggest issue. The other thing, though, is that the staff need to be educated as to why this is something to do. Because, you know, I've been in newsrooms where people say, well, why are we trying so hard to find another black person? Or why are we trying to find another Latino? We already have one or two. I mean, can't we check those boxes off? And nobody says, you know, why are we hiring so many white people? You know, I mean, why is it okay for, you know, 60, 70, 80% of newsrooms, and some places higher than that, some newsrooms are practically all white. You know, why is that okay? And how well will a staff like that cover the entire community? You know, so it just really, really needs to be enforced by the top leadership and explained to the staff.
Which goes to the big question of, oh, I'm sorry, Teresa, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it was kind of, I guess this might be the ultimate $64,000 question. How do we incentivize that at the top? How do we get those who are at the top to make this a priority? How do we get them to see the value in it beyond it's the right thing to do?
Well, I'll tell you what's been done before. There have been some places that created bonus incentives. How well your whatever staff you're responsible, how diverse they are, was tied to your bonus, and you would want people to do it other than a monetary incentive, but if that's what it takes, then I say do that.
Go ahead. This is Teresa, and I was just going to ask you a question, so go ahead.
I was going to say that I think in racing, we have a bigger problem because I am committed to diversity, and yet, you know, short of luring Alicia away from TVG, it would be a very hard thing for me to accomplish right now, because we're not training African-American students. We're not attracting them to horse racing. And I think we're not, because it doesn't reflect their lives right now. And so, there's Greg Harbutt, who has started a lecture series at Wilberforce University, which is a historically black university, in educating young black kids about a career in horse racing. You know, unfortunately, mine is not a general interest publication. And so, you know, I'm faced with having to hire somebody who wants to live in central New Jersey, work nights and weekends, and has an encyclopedic knowledge of thoroughbred horse racing. And like I said, right now, there are not enough black candidates for that. And so what we all need to be committed to in horse racing is investing in these programs that are going to train the sort of people that I can hire in a couple of years.
I think you're on the right track there. And that's one of the things that some big news companies have done. They have started trying to, within their local communities, they try to get young people of color interested in journalism to create a pool that they can draw from as they move through. I mean, there are some summer journalism camps for minority kids. I participated in several of them over the years, and that's one of the things to do. But I will tell you this. it can be difficult to recruit people of color, particularly if you are such a niche publication that doesn't have a natural following of people of color, or at least not a big one. You do have to work harder, and that is true all across journalism and probably in most industries. You do have to be proactive and try to both groom them and work a little harder to find them, and look at the kind of biases that you may unknowingly have for denying people to get in, because I've seen companies that have said, we want to hire, executives, but they need to have these this kind of a background. And the fact is that the type of historic racism within the system limits the number of people who would have those type of criteria. So what do you do? Do you just say, well, that's, we can't find them. Well, the change has to start somewhere, It has to start somewhere if you really want to do this, if that makes sense. And
absolutely.
I'm not speaking specifically to you, Susan. I'm just saying.
No, I understand that.
Yeah.
You're right, though. I mean, we need to commit to training programs, that will teach people how to work in the racing industry. Because, again, it's not a general interest sort of thing. You know, Jason Wilson, who used to be the head of Equibase, said to me, any meeting I am in is the most diverse meeting in horse racing. And he's right about that. He is, he's one of a very small handful of African-Americans who've sort of made it to the, not even made it to the upper ranks. I mean, I would be hard-pressed to find an entry-level person right now. And so I know the Jockey Club has talked about investing in training programs. And like I said, Greg Harbutt in his university is doing the same. And so we all need to be committed to, giving those people a hand up. And
I would suggest this. There are organizations, the National Association of Hispanic Journalists, National Association of Black Journalists, which I'm a member. They might be able to help you. For instance, I'm a member of that organization, have been for a long time, NABJ, National Association of Black Journalists. And I just thought about this within the last 10 minutes. I have a friend that I've known for a long time who is a journalist and who is she used to be a journalist, a very good journalist. She worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and some other newspapers. And then she got a job doing some type of public affairs for the federal government. And right now, her hobby to raise horses, and she is an African-American woman. She's a very good writer, and she probably would be interested in doing some type of freelance pieces about horses. I don't know if she knows about horse racing, but she knows about horses. And, maybe she's interested in learning about horse racing. I'm just saying.
Yeah, that's I obviously hope when this podcast is over, you'll send me her information. We are a business publication, and so the knowledge of the thoroughbred breed is a very specific one. A lot of people apply to us and say, I rode as a child, or my father took me to the track, and it really is a sort of it's like the Wall Street Journal of horse racing in that the knowledge has to be deep. It has to be anyway. I'm not negating your idea. I'm just saying it's one of the challenges. It's not something that horse lovers pick up right away.
Yeah, and I think this is Alicia jumping in here. I think this speaks to one of the broader problems that horse racing as an industry has, period, not just on the journalism side, but with the sport, period, is horse racing has a long history of kind of hiring from the same pool of people over and over and over and over and over and over again. If you go through and look at the board of directors for pretty much any of our operations, you're going to see the same face on a lot of those same boards. And when new positions come open, you're going to often see a name that has held a previous position moved over into that one. So I think one of the things that this sport, if it is serious that it wants to be better, and that's an if, I don't take for granted that that anybody wants to be better, because this is working out for them for a reason, which is why change happens at a glacial speed. But if this industry really wants to change in general, it needs to change its culture, and it also needs to be willing to broaden its base of where it goes and looks for its new talent across the board. You stop looking at the same pools over and over again and open themselves to other avenues. You know, like I said, you know, look at some of the organizations that Rod has mentioned. Look at organizations like HBCU 2020 and things like that. And, you know, don't just keep, but if you're only looking at the same pool of people over and over again, guess what? You're going to hire the same person over and over again. And that's why we're going to see the same kind of ideas and mentality perpetrated till the end of time. So that is one thing I think that needs to be, you know, somehow this sport has to break the chain of it needs to broaden its own lens of where it's looking to bring people into the sport across the board, hiring people, attracting people, how it markets to it. It needs to really change its focus in that sense.
I think you're 1,000,000% right. I think you could, every new job that comes out, you could sort of shake a can full of people and pour one out, one dice, and it's going to be, you know, it's going to be from the same pool over and over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, I think we've had some running jokes of, oh, this position came open, what's the morning line that this person is going to fill it, you know, and we joke about it, but half the time, we're kind of right.
Yeah. Yep.
So I wanted to kind of go back to things from a little bit of the institutional hiring that some of you are talking about. And yeah, I teach at a private school in New York City, and we are a reasonably diverse place, but we're still a predominantly white institution. And as we have tried to attract teachers of color, we have basically had to prove that we as an institution are doing the work around this, that we're not just looking to hire a person, you know, Rod, as you said earlier about, oh, you know, we've checked that box, but that we want to build a truly diverse community. And we as an institution have had to work to make ourselves attractive to teachers of color. Rod, do you think there are things that publications, and definitely not speaking about the TDN here, but publications in general can do to make themselves attractive to journalists of color?
I think exposure is a big one. You're talking about the horse racing industry in general?
Yeah, or any institution. You know, we found at the school where I work that when we have candidates of color who come in, they ask us about what our stances and programming is within the school on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And we have to be ready to say, this is what we're doing. So that person feels like this is a community that they want to join. So even before we get to the hiring part, are there things that various publications can do, whether it's horse racing or not, to say, you know, we too are willing to change in this changing world? And
one of the things
we want to welcome you.
Yeah, one of the things, Teresa, is to have the environment, the work environment, needs to be welcoming and inclusive. So hopefully you already have people of color working there, and that they are treated in a way that they feel welcome there. And because there are a lot of little things that happen that turn people off. My organization, SPJ, is planning a session on retention of journalists of color, because what happens too often is a company will recruit somebody, a journalist of color, they go there, and then they're in meetings and their ideas are never taken. They're not even taken seriously sometimes. social events, they're excluded from them. The same clique of people hang out together, and you know, the new people, the journalists of color never get asked to go out. There might be some practices around the office that are insensitive or offensive, maybe not even intentionally to people of color. So if the environment there is welcoming and inclusive, that makes it easier. Of course, for that to happen, you need to already have some people of color already there. But also exposure. Go out to places where you meet potential people to come in and just have conversations with them about what they would, you know, like to see in a workplace. Not even, you know, whether you hire them or not is irrelevant, but to have conversations so you know what you might have to do to build the type of environment that would be attractive to journalists of color. But I tell you, one of the biggest things is to already have somebody there who is happy.
Mm-hmm. And so we're
interesting.
In chicken and egg position there. You know, how do you create the welcoming atmosphere, have people there, and then, you know, is it the hiring first or the comfort, and how do you get the cycle going? I didn't say that very eloquently. Sue.
Yeah. I can't really speak to that off the top of my head, but I do know that there are people who have a human resources background who know answers to questions like that. Okay. And that's beyond my knowledge area, though.
I'm now flashing back. This is Alicia jumping in here. I'm now flashing back. I remember speaking to a journalism class, and I think I was being asked, like, how often have I been the only person of color in a sports department that I've worked in? And just looking back, I can only recall, I think there's only been one time, and it was when I started with the Herald Leader, that there was another person of color working in sports. So I'm just talking about the sports department, not the whole newspaper as a whole. But there's only been one time in my career where there's been another person of color working in my department with me. Mm-hmm. And again, I've been doing this for 4 or 5 years now.
Mm-hmm. Sue, you were going to say something.
I was going to say that the National Association of Black Journalists is actually a fantastic idea, Rod, and I appreciate your letting me know that they exist. And as we're sitting here talking on the podcast, I've found their email address and started an email to them just to see if, for them to keep me in mind, because if anyone with an interest in horse racing or any knowledge of horse racing comes along, it would be a home run for us. So thank you for that idea.
Sure.
I was so struck by two things that you said. Several, more than that, actually. One, you know, that you've never really had a person of color apply for a job, and that you think that, you know, perhaps 10 years ago, a comment like Barkley Tags, you might not even have published. And, you are in the position here where you've got a bunch of different people to manage. You've got your writers, and you've got the people you interview, and you have advertising and revenue considerations as well. Do you feel any pressure from the ad side? Because we know, particularly in our industry, the people who buy ads are super powerful. How much do you have to take that into account when you think about what you're going to cover and how you're going to cover it?
It doesn't come into account at all in a situation like Barkley Tag or Eric Guillo or Tom Van Meter, for example. In fact, in that instance, we told him that we would no longer accept his advertising. And we published that in the paper because we wanted everybody to know it. Really, I've never felt any pressure. Nor would I consider any pressure to not publish something like that because of an advertising consideration. Honestly, you know, we're independently owned, and we don't need the money that much that we would take that into account, to be honest. And so, you know, I think that when I said 10 years ago we might not have run it, I think it's because you would have thought, wow, that's really inappropriate, or that's so offensive that I'd have a hard time putting this down on paper and sending it out into the world. And I think that's kind of, I think that's kind of the way we used to think. I grew up in a very liberal Northeastern household where I think my parents felt like, because they felt everyone was the same, we didn't need to talk about race. And, you know, it was a very homogeneous town, and, you know, there were a few Black families who were as successful and wealthy as the white families in town. And so I think, you know, I think that growing up, we never pointed out who was Black or who was white or even who was Christian or Jewish, because my parents felt like it didn't matter. And so if they didn't say anything, it wasn't necessary to point it out. And I think, like I said, over the past few years, I think we've all learned that as well-meaning as they might have been, it's not the right decision, that, you know, it's a lot worse than, you know, than we ever realized.
We're coming up to the end of our time here. I want to give everybody a chance to just make any final comments. And I also just think it would be remiss, and I'm sorry that we're out of time so that we can't talk about this some more. But, you know, Rod, when you brought up the Society of Hispanic or Latino Journalists, I was thinking about how many stories I've not been able to write because I don't speak Spanish. How many people on the backstretch that I have wanted to interview, or even jockeys whose English, particularly some of the younger jockeys, who they're working on their English fluency. And I just kind of wonder how many journalists there are in racing who are fluent enough in Spanish to do those interviews. It's a huge regret of mine that I'm not. Rod, anything you want to say before we sign off here?
I just want to go back to the issue of retaining journalists of color once you get them. Alicia had talked about how uncommon it is for there to be another Black person in her department. I think what we should all do is put ourselves in those kind of shoes. If you are a white person and you are the only white person in the room, and just think about how you might feel lonely or isolated or whatever feelings overcome you, then that's what a lot of journalists of color experience their entire lives. For me, it's happened numerous of times where I went to school, where I live, where I worked, you know, many, many times that I was the only Black person there. And so my hope is that trying to put yourself in those shoes, give you some sensitivity about how, if you're that way, then you do need to create this really inclusive and welcoming atmosphere and for people who may feel isolated.
Thank you so much for saying that. Sue, any final comments?
No, I think it's been a great conversation. And like I said earlier, I think it's important that we all start talking about this a hell of a lot more than we ever had in the past. And, you know, we at the TDN are committed to diversity. And, you know, I'm going to do everything I can to not just leave the status quo.
Thanks for that. Alicia?
First and foremost, I just want to thank Rod and Sue again so much for their time, for being part of this today. I said invaluable knowledge as always. And I said thank you, Teresa, for taking the reins and for hosting this. I would just like to, you know, journalism is so important on so many different levels, but I just hope everybody will think about going forward when they're getting their news, think about the lens that their information is being disseminated through and how broad that lens is and how important it is for that lens to be broad to make sure that you are truly getting accurate information.
Alicia, thank you so much for joining as my partner here so many times over these last few weeks. Rod Hicks of the Society of Professional Journalists and Sue Finley of Thoroughbred Dadly News, thank you so much for your time and hope we have a chance to talk again soon.
This has been a Truth to Power podcast powered by The Racing Biz. Learn more and find all of the Truth to Power series on theracingbiz.com.